Hey, it's John Canzano. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe. And thanks to all the listeners and all of our sponsors who help make the Bald-Faced Truth the number one sports radio show in Portland. Enjoy.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. John Canzano.
People don't like to hear the truth all the time. You know, people ask you questions, but they don't actually necessarily want to hear the answers.
Love him.
I mean, I like the guy. I listen to him every day.
Canzano, what's going on, man?
He's dead sexy.
I think he does a damn good job.
I'm going to be rooting for this young Portland team, which, you know, is a terrific team. You guys just have a terrific nucleus.
You pay attention to detail. That's why you're so successful.
I just think he's honest. Straightforward and to the point.
You're bringing up something that's probably the average sports fan watching the game didn't pick up on.
I'm really glad to see that someone who speaks their mind is not afraid to tell it how it is.
He's a smart guy. That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man. I let my mother listen to him.
Hate him.
You don't want to get nobody a second chance. Trump.
To represent that as some sort of subterfuge like John Canzano, I would have expected far better.
He just sounds like an egotistical idiot.
He was rude, crude, and wrong.
Love to hate him.
Yo, John, I can't stand you. I can't stand you, but I come back every day to listen to the show.
Bald faced truth teller.
Who is he to judge?
Well, he can raise your eyebrows a lot.
I was angry. He just got my feathers that day big time.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth. Welcome to a special edition of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show.
My next guest, he's brand new in Philadelphia. I've known him for a long time. Jeff Garcia joins us. Jeff, how are you?
Hey, I'm good, John. How you doing?
Did you get any sleep? I know you took a red eye into Philadelphia.
Oh, I had a really tough night trying to get to sleep last night. I think just, partly the excitement of being here in Philly and returning to Philadelphia and just the welcoming that it seems to have had, the response that I've had from people out here. And, it's really a great feeling being here, but no, I didn't get a whole lot of rest last night, so I'm dragging a little bit today.
Now, you go back to Philadelphia, and you've been around the league. You've Detroit, San Francisco, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Tampa. You go back to Philadelphia. Obviously, you didn't burn any bridges with Andy Reid, and I know when you left there that, the Rocky statue still had a Jeff Garcia T-shirt on it. I mean, the people there, do they just love you?
There is a really positive response from the fans here. I mean, the fact that we turned a season at the time being 5-6 at one point during that year that I was here, turning it around, winning the NFC East, going into the playoffs, winning a playoff game, all of those things. I think it somewhat rejuvenated the city because they were about to give up on the team that year and focus on one of their sports. And I think when that happened, they took me under their wing and treated me like one of their sons. And it was unfortunate that the Eagles, because of the situation at the time, didn't want to extend the contract offer to me. And I became a free agent and had to go elsewhere.
Were you, because I know you started the season in Oakland, and how crazy was Oakland?
Oakland is very crazy. It's just a situation there where you have an owner who's very involved still in the everyday operations of the team, and that's just not on the outside. He's very involved, being right there looking over the head coach's shoulder, and having his influence on what we do as an offense, what we do as a defense, and that makes it difficult on the coaching staff. And more so than that, I think it's affected players within that locker room, and it's just created a sense of it's tough to really bring a team together and create that real bond that a team needs to have in order to compete on a weekly basis. And that's just what I felt was lacking there from a team standpoint. You're always fighting those demons from above you, and it just made it difficult to really create a winning edge. And for me, being at the latter part of my career, as much as I wanted to help that team and I had signed with that team because I grew up in the area and had a chance to return home and be around my family, it just wasn't the right fit for me. And so I had to make a decision and take a situation where I didn't really know which direction I would be going in, but that place was not right for me, and I had to get out of there.
Jeff Garcia, Philadelphia Eagles quarterback. Now, you come to Philly, and you know, you walk into a situation where Donovan McNabb, nobody's really quite sure how hurt he is or how long he may or may not be out. You've got Michael Vick there. Obviously, they have Kevin Cobb there. How long do you expect to be there? Can you unpack your bags? Can you get comfortable? How do you treat this as a veteran guy coming in there?
Well, I'm definitely not looking for housing right now. I'm not going to unpack my bags out of the hotel that I'm staying in, just because it is a very unique situation. It's unique in the sense that there are a stable of quarterbacks. It's a situation where I take it day to day. I could be here 2 weeks. I could be here for a month. I could be here for a season. I think a lot of it, a lot of that has to do with what sort of impact I can have while I'm here. If I do get an opportunity to step on the field, make sure that I'm ready to take advantage of that opportunity. And that's just how I have to approach my situation here. It's not the best opportunity for me as far as creating longevity or giving me security as far as the season goes, as far as being able to lock myself in for an entire season. But I felt like when I look around the league, it was the best fit for me, being able to go to a team that is already familiar with me, players and coaches that are still there that I played for and played with, and to have that and have a system that I'm easily able to adapt to made that fit positive for me. Now I just have to not think about the time and just make the most of the time that I have here.
Now, Jeff, I've known you forever. Went to high school together, went to preschool together. All right. So it's no surprise to me that you have succeeded as a professional athlete. And we're 5 years old playing soccer. You were that good. I mean, you had that competitive desire. What I heard about you after college and as you went into the CFL was he's not big enough, his arm's not strong enough. They never really took into consideration how much of a competitor you were. They never really graded those intangibles. And when you look at the NFL system now as a guy who's been in the league 11 years, are these guys doing a good job grading talent, especially at quarterback? Is there something they could be doing better to identify guys like you that can play?
I think there's definitely something lacking. I think too much time and too much weight is put on certain characteristics like size, like height, like arm strength, like 40 time, those type of things. I think the intangibles of the quarterback position go far and beyond that. If a guy is successful at the college level but yet doesn't meet the height requirements, well, look at why he's successful. Is the guy just a winner? Does he get people to rally around him as a leader? Is he smart? What type of people does he surround himself with? What type of student was he in the classroom? All of those type of things are I think, measurables that are important as far as grading a quarterback. I think just standing him up against the wall, checking out his size, taking him out on the field and seeing how far he can throw bombs, that has nothing to do with being successful on the field. It's all about how you rally a team around you. It's about heart. It's about your mindset. It's about how you can grasp and adapt the system. It's a mentality. And not everybody has that who plays the position. Some guys are blessed with some ability and are surrounded by great talent, and it allows them to succeed in certain ways based upon a system. I think you have to look beyond that at times. And, it's just one of those things where a lot of money is being thrown at these young kids coming out of college. You better do your homework, and you better look at why a player should be a part of your team. Oftentimes, that decision doesn't come down to the head coach. General managers, who many of them have never played the game before, are making some of these decisions, and it just kind of goes against, I think, what we all believe in, what this game should be all about. It should be about the best players who bring teams together, and whoever who are able to thrive and be successful in that sort of way, not just because you look good in a uniform.
Jeff Garcia is our guest here on the Bald Faced Truth. Four-time NFL Pro Bowler, four-time CFL All-Star. I went to college at San Jose State. Do you still pay attention to San Jose State football?
I do. I'm not as involved as maybe I'd like to be, just because I've been so far away geographically most of my professional career. But I like to keep tabs on how the team is doing. I saw a bit of the game the other night against Utah, and they were right in that game into the fourth quarter, and unfortunately weren't able to close it out. But they had a tough opener against USC. I hope that once they start playing against the teams where they can match talent level and those type of things, maybe they'll be able to find the success that they need to have.
When you look at the NFL, how has it changed in 11 years that you've been involved?
I think it's changed in the sense of defensive schemes. Well, you have to look at schemes have obviously changed. I think there's always a pattern of what is the new hot thing, and defenses have changed a bit over the years. Offenses bringing in the wildcat type look with receivers and different types of high speed, high athletic type players lining up in the backfield to receive shotgun snaps and those type of things, the variations of offenses. And I think personnel has changed. I mean, players continue to get bigger, faster, and stronger and grow in that way. But I also think that the younger players don't have an understanding of the history of the league, why this league is such a great league and why the NFL game is the top sporting event in this country. I think young players just don't understand. They don't look into it. They don't understand the former players that have played in this league, that have laid the groundwork for them to be able to get the contracts that they have today. Too many guys are caught up in PlayStation and video games and doing those things that just aren't allowing them to mentally grow. And I think that's a shame. I think that's the disappointing side of society today in general. The young people just don't really have an understanding of history and why they've been given this opportunity to have such a great life.
When you talk about the life, and you know, you're in the NFL, you've made it. I mean, that's the pinnacle of football, and every kid who starts out playing wants to make it to the NFL. You've made it. You're there. Is there any part of you that when football's done for you, that will be able to peacefully go back to being a civilian, or will you be one of those guys that always has that taste and always says, man, I miss the competition? How do you fill that void?
That'll be interesting. You know, I don't know. I'm going to have to probably pick something up in some sort of way, because I am a competitive spirit. I do have that in my blood, and it's what drives me. It really is what makes life fun for me, is to be able to compete in some way or another. It's hard for me to just sit back and relax. And I'm sure I'll find satisfaction in what I've been able to experience and attain throughout my life. But I'm sure I'm going to have to find something new that's going to challenge me in certain ways, that's going to drive me, that's going to push me. Otherwise, I feel like I'll just fade away as far as personality is concerned, as far as just everything that I'm about. And I know there are different aspects of life. I'm now married. I have two young kids and hope to have more. And that's going to be more of the important side of my life. I mean, it's definitely the most important thing in my life now, when I compare what's going on in my life. And I know that I'll be spending more time on that side of the tracks, as far as doing things with my children and watching them grow and being a part of their life. And maybe that's where I start to basically funnel my competitive spirit through them and the sports that they take part in, or whatever they choose to do, and just being supportive of them, potentially coaching them in their sports or helping them in school or whatever it may be.
Jeff Garcia on the Bald Faced Truth. Jeff, that's great. I mean, you know, knowing you for so long and, you know, knowing your family, and it's neat to see you now with kids, man. I mean, that's just, to me, that's mind-boggling. And then I look and I'm like, I got a six-year-old too. And, you know, it's weird to be in that situation as a parent. I know when your dad was a football coach, I mean, will you become a football coach?
It's definitely in the blood, and I feel like I could do a great job coaching. But I also know, even though my dad just coached at the junior college level, I know the time commitment that he put into coaching and doing everything that he could do to make sure that team had a chance to succeed. And that meant a lot of time away from home and a lot of time away from my mom and the kids and that sort of stuff. And granted, I wouldn't be where I am today without the fact that my dad was a football coach. I was able to learn the game at such a young age and mentally grow and grasp the game, and that allowed me to excel in so many ways. But I don't know. I may want to look in other directions or different avenues as far as being associated with the game without having to coach the game.
Who's the most talented player you've ever played with?
I've been fortunate enough to be around some very blessed players, and it's hard to really single out one guy. I mean, to be able to play with a guy like Jerry Rice, even though when I played, when I was a teammate of his in San Francisco, he was somewhat on the downside of his career. He was still just a great worker and a true professional. I mean, the way that he approached the game every single day in practice allowed him to experience and grasp the success that he was able to attain. Being around a guy like T.O., I mean, the guy was a physical specimen and had some tremendous skills as far as what he could do with the ball after he made the catch. So I've been very fortunate to be around some guys like that. And, you know, I mean, it's hard to single out just one guy. There are so many talented people at this level.
It's interesting that you bring up T.O. because he's a guy that hasn't always been complimentary about you, but I've always heard you say nothing but nice things about him. Is that hard to do?
It is hard to do. He doesn't deserve me saying anything positive about him with the things that he has said and done or directed toward me. But I'm not that type of guy. I'm not going to get into an argument type match or a put down type match. I mean, the guy has skills. I can acknowledge that. We had a lot of success together in San Francisco. I think just the fact that he won't acknowledge that or never even point to that is just something that he needs to really open his eyes to. It is what it is. I'm not going to stoop to that level. I know that I'm bigger and better than that.
All right, Jeff, I'll cut you loose. Good luck in Philly, and, you know, beyond that, wherever you end up.
Thanks, John. Hey, you take care, and appreciate talking to you.
All right, Jeff Garcia, Philadelphia Eagles quarterback. You asked for big guests. We get Garcia on the show.
Want more of the best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show? Leave it right here. Welcome to a special edition of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show.
Hey, John Canzano here for my good friends at Mattress Firm. Also, I'm here with an early happy 4th of July. I bring that up because you can go into Mattress Firm right now and take advantage of early savings on their 4th of July sale. You shop early and you'll save up to $500 store-wide on the best brands. Right now, during their 4th of July sale, save up to $300 on brands like Hampton, Rhodes, and Serta. Shop early and don't miss best financing either. 0% APR for 6 years. Take advantage of that. Interest-free financing, that means you can start sleeping happy for as little as $15 a month. So why wait any longer? Mattress Firm has a guarantee as well. They make it easy to love your mattress. They know that everyone's perfect night of sleep, yours, mine, your family members, it's all unique. One size does not fit all. That's why at Mattress Firm, they promise that if you don't love your new mattress, you can exchange it or return it for your money back within 120 days. Mattress Firm, yes, that's where you save money and sleep happy. So get yourself out there now and take advantage.
Welcome to a special edition of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show.
Our next guest is an incredible story. Not just an incredible athlete, but an incredible story. Came to the United States at the age of 16. Became a citizen in 2007. Was kidnapped at age 6 while living in Sudan. Has competed in the Olympic Games twice. Was the flag bearer of the Olympics. Imagine carrying the flag for the United States in the Olympics in Beijing, and Lopez Lemong joining us now. Where are you today?
Yes, I'm actually enjoying this beautiful sun here in Lake Oswego, Oregon. And yes, I'm here in America.
You're in America. You're having a good time. Before we get into everything else, I mean, you're such an amazing story. I'm glad that we had a chance to get you onto the show. What was it like to carry the flag for the United States in that Olympics?
Let me just tell you, John. I mean, it's just like a privilege that I was given. Just not to represent this country on the best, like the world stage, sporting world stage ever, but also to represent this nation by carrying the flag and into the opening ceremony. You know, that's basically the flag that I've been searching for many years of my life, and I've been used to live in a refugee camp, and basically the place that we don't have a country, we don't have a flag to be with and like present with, and for me to get a chance and carry our American flag in the opening ceremony in 2008 was just incredible. I cannot even describe it. I don't know. Maybe I'll tell my kids one day, but still, it seems like it's just yesterday. And so I was very, very honored to carry that flag proudly, and while my fellow Olympian athletes follow me just right behind me, and it was just an incredible thing. So I'm happy about it.
What are your first memories of running? The first time, maybe, as that you ran in a race. When did you know you were good at this?
Well, I mean, we always, especially when in my refugee camp when I was a child, when I was a kid, we run to play soccer, you know, and that is the only way you can. If you don't run 30 kilometers around this Takuma refugee camp, you are not allowed. You will not be able to play soccer, because that's basically a way for you to play soccer, and another way for you to, like, you know, because we have a lot of boys who really want to play soccer, but we have many of us. We only need 22 people on the pitch at once, and so for you to run 30 kilometers, it's another way of substituting. You know, all the boys will run faster, and they will play a little bit. By the time we get there, especially the young ones like myself, we will be already tired, and the pitch is ours. So I always want to play soccer. But when I came here, you know, and of course, like Michael Johnson inspired me when I was also 15 years old before I arrived in the United States. But like when I came here, I saw running was something that gave me that, you know, reminded me where I came from and reminded me of my journey, where, you know, what a talent I had, how my legs brought me to, from basically close to death to something that powerful that, you know, I can be able to use as a platform to be able to change other people's lives. And, you know, even to get opportunity to carry American flag, even go to Olympics, you know, represent this nation as an ambassador and as an athlete, you know, and even get an opportunity to, like, run for a great company like Nike. You know, I'm just so happy and so blessed to have this talent, and I'm continuing to develop and multiply and give back to the community as much as I can.
We're talking to Lopez Lemong, who is a two-time Olympian. You did not qualify for the Rio Games, and I heard people say that you had changed distances, you had done other things. What happened there?
Yeah, so I think I prepared so much, and just like I prepared for Beijing Olympics, and I prepared for also London Olympics, and you know, and I just been going through a lot of injuries. You know, I had like a little nagging injury that I'm actually still even doing right now, a little Achilles problem. And so, yeah, I'm still have that fire. You know, I'm still have that fire that I need to be able to, you know, once these injuries all fixed, and I'll be back strong for Tokyo. And because I think my running is still in me, and my like excitement about running and excitement about everything, you know, that comes with running and this great platform I have as an athlete, is still there. And so I'll continue. And it's a little setback, but, you know, I'm not going to be able to go back and say, like, man, I should have done this and this and this. And, you know, but, you know, we already have a great Olympians already representing our nation in Rio, which I was, you know, I follow them every time. I watch them and I, you know, supporting them in the sideline, you know. And so now I'm just, you know, switching back and looking forward to 2020.
I wasn't surprised that Galen Rupp did well in the marathon, but I was surprised at how well he did really running it there for the first time. What did you think of his marathon performance?
Yeah, I thought like the American distance running really did really well, you know, to be honest with you, because, you know, we had many medals that from the distance crew more than, you know, anything, you know, so which is, I see that as a positive way going forward. And now, you know, we are not just like going to Olympics, going to like world championship to make to the finals, but now we are actually contending for the finals, for the medals, and, you know, three spots. And, you know, it was just a good, it's motivating to see that American distance running basically broke that glass ceiling. And, you know, now we are producing and we're competing at the highest level possible. So I was very, very happy about to see our distance runners, you know, like really perform and basically outstage the whole world that, hey, we are here. We are here for the medals as well. So
what do you think's happened there? Are they getting better coaching, better athletes, or kids buying into it more? Why are we getting better at the distances?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm going to have to give credit to the state of Oregon, you know. I think the state of Oregon is just everybody know about running. And, you know, it's just everybody, even kids are, like, even talking about, like, not only talking about Usain Bolt or something like that. They're talking about, like, our superstars. Things like, you know, people like Ashton Eaton, you know, who are our local athletes here. And they grew up here as kids, and they, you know, they went to schools, local schools here, and everything like that. Now, like, they're bringing medals back home. So that is motivating. That's inspiring for the young athletes. And because at the end of the day, we are just trying to, like, we are following the footsteps of the people that motivated us. Like, for example, me and, you know, Michael Johnson, it motivated me and opened my eyes to see running is a sport. And now I'm just kind of like, you know, kind of doing everything I can to be able to inspire other athletes also that follows me that, hey, because they can do better. You know, now you see how the athletes, you know, these kids, you know, kids in high school, it's like they're all signing up to be runners and, you know, track runners, cross-country runners, which is great. We are moving in the right direction. I think the next, you know, the next games and things like that, we'll see. I think we'll be very competitive. And, you know, I'll give credit to the state of Oregon that, you know, yes, we have a, you know, a track town USA in Eugene, and, you know, it's just everybody know about that. It's not just know about running because of you know, pre-Fontaine, but now they're, you know, because we have people who are actually here that are, you know, they're producing and bringing medals back home to Oregon, mostly.
Two-time Olympian Lopez Lamong is our guest. You are running in the Hood to Coast Relay. You guys are raising money. Is it for World Vision?
Yes, exactly. So that's basically what I'm telling you right now, because, like, I run to change people's lives, you know, and I'm very, very happy that I get to meet amazing, tremendous people all across this country that they are want to do, to see people not, like, basically kids like myself not to go through what I went through. And now we have a team, we have about 10 teams, great athletes and amazing athletes. And you know, they all flew from different parts of the country and to, you know, here in Oregon to participate in Hood to Coast. And we are so blessed also to be able to get an opportunity by, you know, to be invited by the Hood to Coast organization to raise money for clean water in South Sudan. And so, as we know, that South Sudan is the youngest country on the planet and also need a lot of help at this moment and this time, you know, and people, especially with the clean water. And so I'm really so excited to see these athletes come and raise money, you know, and to come and participate in this amazing historic Hurtigruten relay. And so Ash Newton and Brianne, Alan Webb, you know, to name the few of the professional runners, they are all supporting our cause. And we invite everybody out there, you would like to join our group, to join our team, you know, to stop by, sign up, and you know, just join our cause, and let's raise money for this country, and, you know, because we really need a lot of our help. And, you know, looking forward to this weekend.
Lopez Lemong is our guest, and you talk about your story, not wanting kids to go through what you went through, kidnapped at 6. Let's go back to that. What do you remember of that experience, and were you aware of what was going on, and did you have any sense that someday you'd come through it?
You know, I was living in the moment that a child, you know, just lost a family, you know, and I was basically, like, not just lost with the war, but I was, like, separated from my family by force. And as a 6 years old, you know, I was just so confused and what's going on, because I was so happy, just like a 6-year-old kid here in you know, Portland. And just imagine that 6-year-old being, like, all of a sudden came and snatched out from the her family hand. I mean, it's just crazy. And so I was just very determined, you know, the whole of my life, from 6 years old to like 16, I know that one day I will meet my family, you know, and that's what kept me going. And one day, you know, with God and, you know, my faith, and kept me, like, you know, I am here, I'm still breathing, and I can, you know, one day I can be able to meet them. You know, when I got an opportunity to come to America, and so that's what really kind of hit me, because I told my family, you know, for the first time, and they were not, like, this is a surprise, because they never hear my story before. And so that's why even my running was like that, because I wanted to be able to run and see, do well in running, and tell the world, like, you know, I'm a refugee, yes, but I can do better. I can contribute to this country. I can change lives to the people that, like, they need me. They need my support. You know, for example, right now with the Hurtigruten, we're raising money for clean water in South Sudan, and now, especially, you know, $50 can provide clean water for one person for life. Just imagine that, $50. You know, and by telling people like that, you know, it's like, oh man, like, I want to sponsor 10 people, you know, and that's the people that we need. All good, like, we come back, we you know, we share our story, and you know, just to help out. And, you know, with this platform I have right now as an athlete, and people know about me, like, I want to be able to maximize that, and see the country of South Sudan, you know, clean water, so that the kids can be able to go to school and maximize their time in school. So instead of going to fetch the water in, like, very far distances and like that, we want them to be in school and not go look for water.
Lopez, when you were taken, you probably figured your family was dead, that you'd never see them again. I saw the TV show where they reunited you. You were with your mother. What was that like to find her eventually?
Wow. John, it was just amazing. I mean, it's the feeling that you get when you open a Christmas present. And my feeling was, it's like Christmas and Easter at the same time, and birthday at the same time. It was just joyous moment. And, you know, and to see this woman, like, she didn't even know that I grew up like that. She didn't even know my voice changes.
Yeah.
She felt like I'm always 6 years old the rest of my life. And it was just incredible. And I cannot describe it in one word. And so I'm happy that, like, you know, again, we'll never lose hope, because when you separate with somebody that you love, one day you will unite. And that day will be the biggest celebration ever. So that day become my birthday, Christmas party, and Easter party, everything. So it was just amazing.
We danced
all night long.
Right now, what's going on in Sudan? How tied in are you, and how are things there?
Yeah, so I'm still following things going on, and which is very sad, very, very, very sad. And, you know, to see the country that was have a lot of hope, you know, and now going through more a problem again, you know. Again, it's a young country, you know. We just have to think that way. And it's a young country that, like, is still kind of like growing into its, like, you know, itself. You know, it will mature eventually. It will be stabilized. And it's just so sad to see people still running away from their villages and their houses. It's like, you know, their homes. You know, be more refugees and stuff like that. And you know, and these are the things that we're trying to, like, we go in. That's why World Vision and Team World Vision are, like, so determined, because we all came together as a partnership to go back to where those affected areas are, especially the northern part of for South Sudan, and you know, and just go in and help these kids who have been displaced from the, you know, from the civil war and stuff like that, and provide clean water for them, provide like education for them, and you know, and just and healthcare, you know, medicine and stuff like that, and you also give some hope as well to these kids. Like, you know, the world is not ending. It's, you know, there is people out there. There is people in Oregon right now this weekend that are running to bring hope to you, to give you clean water. You know, and these are the good stories of hope that these kids need to know about, and that is some basically say, like, there's people out there care for you. So you know, I'm following you know, the situation right now, going, you know, like ongoing situation, and hopefully we pray people will come back to the senses and stop war and put guns away and put the pencils and pen into kids' hands and for the future.
Lopez Lamong, he's running Hood to Coast, and he's doing it for a good reason. He also has a book. He came out with a book a few years ago called Running for My Life, One Lost Boy's Journey from the Killing Fields of Sudan to the Olympic Games. It's a must-read. Lopez, thank you so much for your time. We'd love to have you back on, maybe, you know, as things develop and your story continues to soar.
Thank you so much. Please, please read that book, Running for My Life. It's an incredible story. It'll change your life.
Want more of the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show? Leave it right here.
Something is about to happen.
BFT.
Now listen up, everyone.
Let's go. The Bald-Faced Truth.
John Canzano.
I gotta say, I love him most of the time. I think he's right on.
He's okay.
John's great. He's a little unusual.
Live every afternoon, 12 to 3 p.m.
I hate that guy, because he just never knows what he's talking about.
I think he does a damn good job.
That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man. I let my mother listen to him.
Now, from the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald-Faced Truth. Want more of the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show? Leave it right here.
And Tom Glavin joins us now. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
What's that been like for you? Because for some guys, they start their career looking at the Hall of Fame, and other guys, they just compete, and they look up one day, and they're in the Hall of Fame. Which are you?
I mean, a little bit of both, you know. I mean, I think that, you know, as I've said to people, they're certain points in time where things happen and you start to, you know, maybe analyze yourself a little bit. And I know for me, you know, a couple of those things were first time I won a Cy Young Award. And, you know, you start looking at the list of guys who've won the Cy Young Awards and it's like, wow, that's, you know, some pretty good company, what have you. And then I think when I won my second one, that list became even more exclusive. So, you know, then you do it again. 250 wins, I guess. I did it a little bit, and you know, so I mean, it's mental, but it certainly wasn't the kind of thing that I spent a whole lot of time thinking about. I think when certain things happen, particularly milestone type things, it a lot of that conversation, and you can't help but look at it a little bit, but don't spend a whole lot of time on it.
You were a excellent hockey player in high school. Is that accurate? Were you excellent?
Well, I was probably a better hockey player coming out of high school than I was a baseball player. So yeah, I was okay.
What made you choose baseball? Given you were drafted by the Kings in the NHL draft, you had a chance to play baseball. What was the deciding factor for you?
You know, it was more about the opportunity. You know, I was going to college to play both sports. Through that whole process, I wasn't really ready to give one up. So I was trying to find a school where I could go and play both. Once I got drafted in both sports, you know, it's just a different dynamic. In hockey, they hold your rights for a longer period of time. They really don't push to sign you, especially a high school kid. Baseball is different. They hold your rights for, you know, 6 months or whenever school starts, and they want to get you signed, particularly a high school kid. So, you know, the Braves really were aggressive and came after me. And, you know, once that whole process started, it really became, do I want to take a chance on baseball right now? Or do I want to go to school and get an education? And I guess, you know, being a second round pick, I didn't really feel like I was going to up my ante in the draft anymore if I kept playing and went to college. And, you know, and then ultimately I knew being a left-handed pitcher, I had an advantage in baseball that I didn't have in hockey, and I probably should try and make use of that.
Hall of Famer Tom Glavine, our guest. When you look at your career stats, you look at the 17 losses in 88. By 91, you're a 20-game winner. You're a Cy Young Award winner. What happened in that span?
You know, a couple things. After my first couple of years in the big leagues, it became obvious that I needed to improve my command, and that was something that I worked on and tried to get better with, and I did. You know, I had a good year my second year in the big leagues and then kind of fell back a little bit. And, you know, I think mostly that inconsistency was, number one, what so many young players go through. It's tough finding that consistency level. But probably more importantly, I really didn't have a secondary pitch up until that point in time that I could trust. And, you know, if I went out there on a given night early in my career and I had my good command and I had a good breaking ball to go with it, then I had a chance to pitch a good game. But if I didn't, then I struggled. And in 91, I figured out my changeup, and it became a huge pitch for me, and it gave me that secondary pitch that I could trust, that I could throw behind in the count or ahead in the count or any time I wanted to. And, you know, that was the thing I think that really made the difference for me, was having that that pitch to go along with my fastball that I could count on. And, you know, once I started having success, then the confidence grew and everything kind of took off.
When you say figured out your changeup, what goes into figuring that out?
You know, for me, it was all about the grip. You know, I had thrown a circle changeup up until that point in time, and it was inconsistent for me. You know, I never had the confidence that I was going to throw it exactly the way I wanted to. You know, there were some nights it was there, some nights it wasn't. Some, you know, a lot of times I felt like I had to manipulate my arm speed a little bit, which is the last thing you want to do on a changeup. And, you know, in the spring of 91, I kind of fell upon my grip that I used for the rest of my career. And really that was the key for me. The grip that I switched to was such that it took away any of the guesswork for me. I knew that just because of the way I was throwing the ball, I couldn't throw it as hard as my fastball. And it made it real easy to keep that same arm speed and stay aggressive. And then it was just a matter of trying to figure out how to command it. And fortunately, I was able to do that.
10-time All-Star, World Series champion, 2-time National League Cy Young Award winner Tom Glavine is our guest. You know, so much of pitching we hear about mechanics being repeating, you know, the same things over and over. You want the arm speed, you want the motion the same. How much tinkering do you do in an off season between all of those years that you played? And can that be counterproductive to what you're trying to accomplish during the regular season?
You know, I wouldn't say I did a ton of tinkering. You know, I mean, I think every year I would go into the off season, try and figure out, all right, what can I do better? What can I be more consistent with? And there was always something. You know, I think for me, after those first couple of years where I started to really feel comfortable with my mechanics, then there wasn't a whole lot of tinkering going on. You know, from that point on, I felt pretty good. Now, later in my career, I kind of went through another adjustment where I changed some things in terms of how I stood on the mound and how I got into my delivery and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, really that was just a result of, for whatever reason, I didn't feel comfortable doing things the way I had been doing it for a long time. And so I made it just a slight little adjustment. But, you know, I think more than anything, you make small adjustments maybe from time to time. And I know for me, most of the adjustments I made were to try and eliminate some movement so that I had less things going on and therefore I had less things that could go wrong. You know, but I think eventually for me anyway, I got to a point where I was fairly consistent and fairly comfortable with my mechanics, and I tried not to mess with them too much.
Catchers are often not given enough credit when a pitcher comes out and throws a good game. How in sync were you with your catchers, or maybe one that you had over a long time? Did you do a lot of talking before games, or did he just kind of know you?
You know, I think they knew you, obviously. I mean, I think for me it was, you know, different times, different catchers, different philosophies. But for the most part, you know, most of our catchers were fairly similar.
Maybe a guy like Javi Lopez.
Trying to do in order. Yeah, I mean, a guy like Javi, you know, I mean, Javi, you know, I think for me anyway, I tried to take a lot of the guesswork out of it for Javi, you know. I mean, he knew what I was trying to do, and I essentially said to him, look, if you're not sure what to do or what I want to do, then let's just go with a changeup, and we'll go from there. I'll shake you off from there. So, I mean, I think that made it a little bit easier. You know, the last thing you want to do is get on the mound and start shaking, and you know, wasting a lot of time. So, I mean, you'd make little adjustments from time to time like that, but for the most part, I think those guys were pretty in sync with what we were trying to do and what our philosophies were, and it made it pretty easy. We were fortunate for as far as the pitching staff was concerned in that regard.
For outsiders who look in, we talk about scouting and baseball being such a big part of it. That conversation where you're having with maybe the catcher, or are there other pitchers involved and pitching coaches, as you go down the opposing lineup, how was that in baseball over the years? And did that change at all in your career?
It did. You know, I think the way we did it in Atlanta was probably the way a lot of teams did it. But, you know, we would get together before, you know, the first game of each series, and we would go over every hitter. And you go through the likes and the dislikes and who's hot and who's not. But ultimately, you know, it was up to each individual pitcher to stick to your game plan in terms of doing what you did well. You know, I mean, and by that, I mean, well, if I heard that, you know, so-and-so was not a good breaking ball hitter, that really didn't matter a whole lot to me because I didn't throw a whole lot of breaking balls, you know. So I wanted to know more stuff like, you know, was he a good fastball hitter or a good off-speed hitter in general? Was he, you know, did he like the ball in? Did he like the ball away? And then I would kind of try and incorporate some of those things. But really, I went out there and tried to do what I did well and made that the focal point of my game plan. And if somebody showed me that they were going to beat me at what I was trying to do, then you make adjustments. I think as time went on, the biggest change in the game was video. You know, it got to a point where my last 3 or 4 years, there was so much video available on guys. You could just sit there and watch, you know, literally the software systems they had. You could, if you were getting ready to play the Phillies, for example, I could pull up the Phillies and I could pull up Chase Utley and I could watch, you know, the last 60 at-bats he's had against left-handed pitchers. So that was very helpful because, you know, what it did then is it really put the game plan or the scouting report in your hands. You could watch it, you could see it, and it really helped too in that you could always pick out guys that had similar styles to you. And if you had a guy that you struggled with, you might, you know, for me, I might say, hey, well, you know, I struggle with this guy. Well, let me check out Jamie Moyer. How's he getting them out? What's he doing different than I'm doing? And see if some things that he was doing that I could incorporate. And, you know, that was probably the biggest change was just the video and how much was there and how much you could utilize it.
How would you approach a guy like Barry Bonds? Do you remember a plan for him, or is that different than any other hitter when you run into a guy like that?
It depended. You know, early in Barry's career, you know, you tried to be careful with him away or inside and try to make him beat your way. You know, when he was hitting all those home runs, you just tried to be careful in general. You know, try not to let him beat you or, you know, certainly not leave a pitch over the plate that he could drive out of the ballpark. You were content giving up a single or even a double a lot of times to him. But, you know, then there were times too, like early in his career, you know, you might be careful with him during the regular season, but for whatever reason, you know, he struggled against us in the postseason the couple of years that we faced him, and then you kind of turned it up a notch and got ultra aggressive on him and tried to you know, tried to feed off that anxiousness that he had, you know, in terms of trying to dispel some of those notions. So different times, different things. But, you know, over the latter part of his career, yeah, you just tried to keep him in the ballpark and you were satisfied if he got three singles on a given night.
Tom Glavin, our guest here on 750 The Game. You go in with Greg Maddux. What does it mean to you?
Well, it means a lot. You know, like I've said to people, going in is an honor and it's a big deal. And to have an opportunity to go with Bobby and Greg, it makes it even that much more special. I mean, those are two guys that certainly were huge influences on my career, two guys that I spent a chunk of my career with. You know, Bobby was certainly the biggest influence in an overall baseball capacity on me. Greg certainly was a huge influence in terms of, you know, being a motivator and watching him pitch and certainly wanted to keep up with his success. And then, you know, just conversations that we would have about pitching and things that he did that I can incorporate in my game plan. So, I mean, both those guys had big, big influences on me. So, like I said, it takes what's already, to some extent, an unbelievable honor and something that I'm looking forward to. It makes it even better. Because I'll get the chance to go in with those guys and certainly get an opportunity to thank them as well.
You know, there was a period where you went to the Mets and then came back to Atlanta, but I have to think you spent so much time, you know, in that Atlanta dugout and in that Atlanta bullpen and hanging out with the pitchers. Was it tough for you while you were away to not talk to those guys on a regular basis, or did you guys talk?
No, we talked a little bit. You know, certainly whenever we were in town with each other, we'd talk quite a bit. You know, from time to time, I know, especially with Smoltz, I'd get a phone call from him and, you know, he'd kind of clue me in on what was going on or things like of that nature. Or if, you know, there was something that he was struggling with or wanted to vent about, you know, we would. And that was the beauty of the relationship that the three of us had for those years. Not only, do we have, success, on the baseball field, but we had a ton of fun off the baseball field as well. And, you know, we knew each other so well. We knew, when we were struggling, each other was struggling, the things to look for, the things to say, to try and get each other out of it. So it was just a really unique relationship between the three of us in that regard.
You know, I look at, you know, the starts by catchers and pitchers, and it looked like the guy who caught you more often than not, in Atlanta wasn't Javi. Is that right? Was it, I'm blanking on the other guy's name.
I'm trying to think. You know, Javi certainly for a large portion of it. You know,
Greg Olson. That's right.
Yeah, Greg Olson, early '90s. Yeah, and then Javi kind of took over there in the mid '90s and through the, you know, into the 2000s. So, you know, that's what I say. We over the years we had a number of catchers and we had a number of backup catchers. But you know, the great thing was that you know, they were all very similar styles. You know, I mean, Javi might have been. No, not might have. Harvey certainly was the more offensive of all the guys that we had, but certainly still a good defensive catcher. You know, all those other guys, whether it was Olson or Barry Hill or Eddie Perez, I mean, all those guys, Charlie O'Brien, they all were great defensive catchers, called great games. So we were really lucky in the sense that we didn't feel like from one guy to another there really was a huge adjustment in terms of what we were going to try and do or what they were going to try and have us do.
And you see some guys who prefer certain catchers. That had to be a nice luxury in Atlanta that it seemed like the organization understood that pitching and defense was a big part of what you guys were doing.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that's essentially how we tried to do things was pitching and defense and, you know, try to put our offense in a position where we didn't have to score a ton of runs on a given night. And, you know, that was a beautiful thing to be able to be a part of that, like I say. And, you know, for all the catchers that we had go through there, you know, I think Greg was the guy that always seemed to take the backup guy and that was his guy. And it was kind of a built-in way to give Javi a night off and give him the rest that he needed over the course of the year. So it was really, like I say, really a good situation all the way around. And, you know, we were just, I know I was, blessed to be a part of it because it was a lot of fun.
Before I cut you loose, Tom, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. The phone call that you got that said you were in, who did the phone call come from and what was that like?
Oh, it came from Jack, the head of the Baseball Writers Association. I'm drawing a blank on his last name for some reason for a second here. But, you know, it was a surreal phone call. You know, Jack O'Connell, that was it, sorry.
Yeah.
But it's one of those phone calls where, you know, when it comes in, You know, my first inclination was to make sure it was Jack, and make sure it wasn't somebody, that was either playing a joke on me or somebody that was selling something. So, you know, that was the first inclination. And then once, you know, he identified himself and said, hey, congratulations, you're in the Hall of Fame. It was just, I'm not really sure what he said after that, to be honest with you, because I think the flood of emotions that go through you and the thoughts that you have from Little League to, you know, mom and dad to your family to everybody that's been there for you is just, you know, it's hard to put it all in perspective, but there's certainly never been much quite like that phone call in my life. So it was pretty neat.
How soon does your mind go to who else is in? Who else got voted in?
Very quickly. That was my first question. I said, "Hey, so is Greg in? So I can give him a text." And he wouldn't tell me. So you know, they do a very good job of keeping that thing under wraps until the 2 o'clock announcement came out. But you know, it's funny. I say I was making sure it wasn't somebody playing a joke on me, and I found out later that week that you know, Kathy Maddox, Greg's wife, was telling me that Greg wanted to call me like early in the morning and tell me, you know, I already got my phone call. Has anybody called you yet? But she wouldn't let him. So I had reason to make sure nobody was calling me and pranking me.
Tom Glavine, I really appreciate your time. Congratulations to you. Well deserved.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show. Stay tuned for more.
Hey, Canzano here. Let's imagine your family rig or your work rig is down for service, and the Yahoo at the shop tells you, hey, we're a little busy, it's going to be a few days. A few days! To him, it's not a big deal, but to you, if your truck's not working or your family vehicle isn't working, let's face it, you're not working. Go to the one place you can trust to keep your fleet or your family on the road and keep you in business. Go see Bess and her team at the Quick Lane inside Gresham Ford. Bess has more master technician and heaven diesel techs than just about anybody in the region. They're who I use. You should use them as well. Doesn't matter what brand or model of vehicles are in your fleet or in your driveway. The Quick Lanes inside Gresham Ford will make sure the wheels of your family or your business keep turning. So call the Quick Lane inside Gresham Ford and ask him about the care and maintenance of your vehicles. On Powell, two blocks east of 242nd. Go see Bess and her team. The Quick Lane inside Gresham Ford. GreshamFord.com. Whether it's your fleet or your family, Gresham Ford has you covered.
Want more of the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show? Leave it right here. You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show. Stay tuned for more.
Mike Leach joining us. You have some favorite hangouts in Portland when you come down here?
You know what I love about Portland is, you know, the best hangout in Portland really is Portland. It's like Key West where, you know, I go and I'm, you know, known to go and whatnot. You know, you just go downtown and you hang out. You know, you walk out of your hotel. What are you going to do that day? I don't know. You know, you just go walk around. And so then in how the day evolves is you'll see all kinds of different people. And the people's what makes Portland most fascinating. You know, it's pretty, too. So it's like between interesting people. I mean, it's like, all right, no interesting people right here. Well, it's pretty. So you look at, you know, kind of the beauty of the place. I like that, you know, it's kind of subtle. But I got to thinking about this last time I was in Portland. It's kind of subtle, but you know, all that molded iron they have on buildings or
yeah.
Just at the base of something or a fence of something. I like that. I like, you know, you just walk around and see where the day takes you. The day might take you down there by the river. You know, you might ride the, and it's a great bike town. I love that. And then, you just see something and get curious about it. All of a sudden there's, you know, there's these lofts in some kind of warehouse and you just sort of, you don't get to go in, but you imagine what it'd be like. All the little bars and restaurants, they're all different and unique and typically have a history to them. The best thing about Portland is you just walk around and you don't know what's going to happen that day, but it ends up somewhere, you know.
I was driving this morning and I drove by Powell's Books and I saw people in there reading books and I thought that's a good thing because I miss bookstores. Like I grew up with my dad taking me to the bookstore and saying, okay, go get lost for an hour in here and we'll meet back here. And I worry with like my 13-year-old, she's on her phone all the time. That's going to be lost on the generation. Do you see that in players? Do you get players who like have never really hung out in a bookstore?
Oh, I mean, we're talking about the There's I've got players that don't talk to people, that they haven't talked to a person in 10 years, you know, because they only work through their phone or a computer. I mean, and other than football practice, they'll look up, and if they actually see somebody that's talking to them, they'll be a little stunned, and they get the whole startled thing, like, oh, what's this in front of me, you know. Now Powell's Books, what a facility that is. So I go to Powell's Books, right? And it was kind of in the middle of the night, you know, it's like late, you know, it's all of the Powell's Books, and, you know, there's all kinds of floors, and it crawls all over a couple blocks, you know, and so you go in there, and there's people drinking coffee and reading books, and there's just books everywhere. I mean, I didn't realize, I doubt the Library of Congress is as big as Powell Books. So I go in there, and at the time is when my book on Geronimo had come out. And so, you know, I tiptoe on Powell's Books because if you're a book guy, I mean, it's sort of you have a little bit of a reverence to the place, you know, because you've heard about it, you know. And so then you go in there, and there's just books everywhere. And I'm thinking, well, I'm going to see if they got Geronimo in here. And so, well, I mean, I don't even know where to start. I mean, the place is so big. I mean, I don't know where to start. And then I look on this, you know, the thing, kind of a map thing, and it says, well, you know, this is, I discover this thing goes everywhere. So I tiptoe up to the information desk. I go, you know, in kind of a hushed voice, you know, you don't happen to have the book Geronimo by Mike Leach, do you? And the lady says, well, let me see. You know, types away on this thing. Bam. She says, yes, we do. We've got, you know, the X number of copies. I mean, she knows exactly how many copies. Can I get you one? No, I was just curious. I'm Mike Leach. I just wondered if you carried the book. And she goes, oh, well, I see you have another book here, too. You did, you know, Swing Your Sword. So then, I can't remember. It was like just insanely efficient. It was insanely efficient. Yeah. So she says, all right. And then all of a sudden just has somebody makes a call. Somebody comes racing up. I'm not sure if it was on a bicycle or what. Comes racing up, you know, with all these books. It says, here, we need you to sign all these.
Yeah.
They'll sell better if you sign. So it brings them all up there, has me. But, I mean, just bam, like it's a whole system thing. No, it's like one of the most impressive things ever with regard to books.
Washington State football coach Mike Leach is our guest. You touched on the player who are the people you say are disconnected from humans. How do you teach those kids if they learn or they're so accustomed to technology is where they're getting all their information?
We try to utilize the technology to teach it. They each get an iPad, and this isn't unusual in Division I. They each get an iPad and it's good academically. So they each get an iPad. So academically, anybody academically needs to get word to them, and they'll send them assignments or the tutors, all that. They send their messages that way. As soon as they're done with practice, they have the practice on their iPad, so they start, you know, hopefully looking at it on their iPad, and or even film upcoming opponent, maybe clips you want them to see or corrections you want them to make. Boom, it's on their iPad. You use it, you know, use it to you know, in other words, speak in their language, so to speak, and try to get stuff accomplished. But then the other thing is, I think that's one of the strongest things about football in a team game. I mean, because there's a locker room full of people where from all different walks of life, all different backgrounds, that they're in a situation where they're forced to hang out and talk to one another and engage directly in a fashion that, you know, just an individual student, depending on his inclination, might not always have the opportunity. Like, say I'm a really smart kid that, you know, is really motivated by my computer, my phone, and, you know, smart, get my stuff done. But, you know, in my spare time, I play little games on it or whatever. You might lose that kind of edge for interpersonal connection, where I do think football and just the team aspect of it enhances it, because These guys are in locker rooms together. They eat together, the whole thing. The other thing I do to try to push it a step further, the biggest thing is I want team unity. But when it comes to the locker room, you know, when we assign them a locker, I try to have them have you between people you have the least amount in common with. In other words, a guy like me, say, okay, let's say I'm a freshman wide receiver from Wyoming. I'd probably be next to my right would be a black defensive lineman from South Central LA. And then on the other side might be, some other different background, maybe one of the island guys that's a linebacker. You know, just people, whoever you don't have anything in common with, I want that thing woven together in a fashion where they have to talk to each other, where you have to get to know people you wouldn't ordinarily know. And because, you know, for example, the starting offensive lineman on our team isn't going to do a whole lot of drills with, say, the freshman corner. You know what I mean? Like a senior offensive lineman's not going to have a lot of drills that he's going to do with, say, a freshman corner. I want those guys to know each other. And you can't there's not a perfect system to it, but I think you can help it along. You can kind of push it along.
You won 9 games last year. You probably should have won 10 or 11. When you look back, do you, as a coach, are you tortured by that? Do you look back at that? Do you go through things, or do you leave the past in the past and start forging ahead immediately?
Well, you start forging ahead immediately. I think early we had a lot of really young guys that tried really hard, worked really hard, but I just think that's how good we were as a team. I mean, we weren't, you look at our sideline and a bunch of those guys had never stood on a college sideline. I mean, you know, half of our guys that were playing in that game had never even played a college football game. And because we were freshmen and sophomores, or redshirt, more redshirt freshmen even than sophomores. And so then I just don't know if we were any better than that. I mean, it's disappointing. And we got better. I mean, we stuck with and got better quick, and we worked hard, and it was meaningful to us, but just weren't blended together as a team. And then when we played Stanford, I felt like we should have won the Stanford game. First of all, I think that there were several. We outplayed Stanford everywhere but on the scoreboard, and then there were a couple things that occurred in that game that are beyond my control that I get fined if I comment on. that were just brutally bad.
I think that's a bad system. They do that in the NBA. I think that's a lousy system. That there's almost no accountability for the officials, and everyone knows that you guys are frustrated. I think it's a horrible system where they say you can't talk about it.
Well, what's difficult about it? What's difficult about it is nobody talks about it, and that's not workable. I mean, it's like anytime you're not honest with somebody about something, it becomes difficult. You know, because I remember, like, all the steroid stuff when that first happened. Well, the first approach on steroids, when they discovered they were bad for you, they said they don't do anything for you. Yeah. They don't do anything for you. They don't affect you. Well, then, of course, as guys would discover that they did, well, then the credibility on the people telling them it was bad for you, that went out the window, because those same people told them it didn't do anything, you know. And so I think that whole thing gets haywire where, you know, you want to change some behavior, but then you lie about why, or you're not honest about why. But what I think on those, the officiating thing is, I think as soon as the game's concluded, that the referee should be the first guy in the press conference. And he should take any questions that the media wants to ask about officiating. You know, and games aren't going to be called perfectly. Some are going to be very well called games, but not perfectly. And And so then he should answer it. And then it takes it off the coaches, because the first thing they're going to do is ask the coaches. And we're not allowed to talk about it unless we want to get fined. And I've done it both ways. And but they're going to ask, and because they want, you know, they want to know, and on a certain level have a right to have some dialogue on it, although not with the coach. And then, but if the referee, who's the ground zero on the call, comes and addresses it, then the coach can say, well, that's taken up with the referee. Well, the referee will answer all your questions on that. And right now we don't have any system like that. And if the coach has to talk about the game, I don't know why the referee wouldn't.
Yeah, and I feel that way in the NBA as well, where, you know, the officials themselves don't even know how they're graded. It's just a wacky system. The football question that I'm going to mix in here amid the politics and Powell's books and everything is, you know, 9 wins last season. Everybody was young. We heard people complaining all year, hey, we're young, we're young. You guys somehow overcame and grew through that and ended up beating Oregon on the road and beating UCLA. And what was it that you think you got out of that group? How did you grow those guys?
You know, the biggest thing is you just hang together and work hard. I know that sounds simple. It's a little harder to do because you got to, within your unit, you got to keep everybody engaged, and they've got to be constantly reinforcing each other, because anytime things are frustrating or tough and everybody wants success immediately. And the other thing is to have any level of success, you have to work incredibly hard for it. So holding everybody together, I think, was a big part. I think our players had a big role in that. And the other thing, I think that, there was a point to where it became fun, incredibly competitive, incredibly hardworking, very nasty at times. But, you know, just got kind of consumed by the chase. And then the other thing, and especially for a young group, we never allowed ourselves to get distracted. I can't say never, but we did a good job of not getting distracted by disappointment and playing through to the end of the game. I mean, if you think about all those games we had, a lot of them were won, you know, just literally the last series. We beat 6 teams. We were double-digit underdogs 6 times and won. I think we did a really good job of over time focusing on ourselves, you know, maybe because we were young enough and dumb enough we didn't know to do anything else, and hopefully we maintained that.
The political process here is going to wind up, and we've got conventions coming and nominations and a general election for the presidency. I keep looking at the candidates and going, we have how many millions of people in this country, and this is who we've got?
Well, I mean, I couldn't get you to run. I sure I was going to call you, you know. And I think, you know, that as far as what's going on, I think people in general are very frustrated. I think people are frustrated and both parties, I think too often, I think, we tend to identify ourselves with this party, that party, rather than Americans. And then it becomes like some kind of rabid fan for a sports team, you know, where people are just cheerleading one side or the other. I think both sides are very frustrated. And I think you can see that. I mean, there's a huge voice, and I think both sides are more similar than they realize. I think the general guy walking the street, I mean, whether they're a Republican or whether they're a Democrat, they're tired of nothing getting accomplished. They're tired of people selfishly not meeting in the middle of the aisle to try to solve what's best for this country. And then I think it's manifest. Well, you can see it on the Republican side, and I think that was revealed first. I think part of the reason you saw it on the Republican side first is because the Democrats had the presidency, and so then it's like, well, you know, the Republicans are being spoon-fed an establishment candidate, initially Jeb Bush in particular. And as they began to gag and refuse to accept that, because, you know, they're tired of seeing, you know, people go in there and get nothing accomplished after term after term after term. And so they want to try something different. Whether something different's better or not, it's still worth a try, because you're not just doing the same thing over and over again. And then so Trump explodes, and some of that has to do with because people like his policy. Some of it has to do with because they just want to try something different for the sake of, you know, what we're doing is not working. Then on the Democratic side, I think there was a very false sense of security, you know, because Hillary, I think, is viewed as a bit of an incumbent over there. And, you know, this nomination was supposed to just be a coronation for her. And I think the Democrats failed to identify the frustration on their own side as well, which I think there's a great deal of it, because 6 years ago, nobody could tell you who Bernie Sanders was. And I think it's fair to say 3 years ago, nobody could tell you who Bernie Sanders was. And so then as a result, you know, he beats her in as many states as he loses to her in. Except for the fact, I mean, it is in fact rigged over there on the Democratic side. And I think we do got to think about whether or not, with regard to their primaries, that Democrat votes should count. The Republicans pretend that theirs count, and they count more than the Democrats do, but they still don't totally count. And then, so I think it's symptomatic on both sides. I mean, you can't explain Trump if that's not true on the Republican side, and you also can't explain, you know, Bernie Sanders. I mean, how is Bernie Sanders' force this strong if you've got a bunch of fat, happy Democrats that think everything's going perfect? Because so I think there's a lot more similarities than there are differences, really.
Mike Leach, you can pick up Geronimo autographed at Powell's Books. If they're out of autographed copies, so you got to get down there and do another signing in the middle of the night.
Oh, I'll tell you. Well, the thing is that's a, and I didn't have time to do it, but I guarantee you, if you go around Powell's Books, you'll meet some cats, because there's people studying research. There's probably a Nobel Prize winner in there somewhere.
Probably is. Coach, thank you so much.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on.
Want more of the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show? Leave it right here.
I want you all to listen up. This is important stuff, all right?
Okay. Here we go.
The Bald-Faced Truth.
Call 503-417-7575 or 877-733-0750 or text to 64636.
Here we go in 3, 2.
Now, from the Pac West Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald-Faced Truth. You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show. Stay tuned for more.
I want to bring on Bobby Bowden, Florida State legend, two-time national champion. What is that like when you win a national championship and you're walking off the field, Coach?
Well, it's the climax of your goals to win a national championship. You know, every coach that coaches hopes that someday he can win a national championship. So it's you could see it on his face, even though that was his fifth one. It was a great feeling of accomplishment. You could tell it.
I see with coaches all the time, because you know, for most of the coaches, it doesn't end with you walking off the field and people pouring Gatorade on you most seasons, that a lot of time it's about building for next year, building what went wrong. He looked relieved, and he looked, you know, genuinely happy. Were you that way when you won, or was there always something looming in the back of your mind?
No, I we played for 5 national championships. We won 2 of them. And you go into all of them thinking you can win, but knowing you got a fight on your hand. And when you do win, it's just that great feeling of accomplishment. I remember the first year we won a national championship in '93, we had been in the top 4 for the previous 5 years. And, you know, people say, oh, he just can't win it. He just can't win the big one. He can't get the big one. And we finally won it. And it was kind of like the weight's off your back. But the second one, we won. Then it felt like more of an accomplishment. You know, we were first in the nation at the start of the nation. We were number one in every week, and then finally won it. And that was kind of a feeling of accomplishment.
We're talking to Bobby Bowden, now 86 years old. Where did you watch the game?
I watched it right here in my living room. Watched every bit of it. It was a great game.
Alabama win or Clemson lose?
You're bringing up something I've always said about coaching, and it's kind of a coach's cliche, really. You don't win games, you lose them. Now you say, well, hold on, how does that work? Well, when Clemson blew their coverage, Alabama caught a gimme touchdown pass, and when they blew it another time, they caught another touchdown pass. So you lost the game, and so you lose games, you don't win them, and that was the case last night of Clemson losing the game.
I watch Nick Saban, and I say to myself, I say he's getting all the best players, and of course he's sniffing around it. But then I see the onside kick, and I see the way he managed that game. How surprised were you that they onside kicked there?
I was surprised, but yet it was the smartest thing he could do. It was the smartest move of the whole night, because he stated afterwards, somebody asked him, why did you do that? How did you have the nerve to do it? He said, well, we couldn't stop them. We couldn't stop them. So whether they got the ball on their 40 or whether they got it on their 5, they keep driving for touchdowns, you know. And so he had to get that ball back away from them, and he did it, and it was probably the move of the game.
A move like that blows up on you, and you look bad. I mean, as they're lining up for that onside kick, you've been in that situation. What's your stomach doing as a coach when you have a call on like that and you're waiting for it to unfold?
Oh, you're saying, oh, I hope this works. Oh, I hope this works. You know, my son Tommy did that against me one time when he was at Clemson, and he did that on me one time. And boy, it hurts, because you're fixing to get the ball. You know, you're fixing to get the ball, and you finally stop them. You know, and or you know, at least you're gonna get the ball back, and then all of a sudden they got it. It hurts. It hurts.
I think Christian McCaffrey at Stanford, if you put him behind that Alabama offensive line, he runs for 300 yards. I mean, that offensive line is imposing.
They really are. You know, I really like him. I don't know if he won the best player in the country last year. And he's got, what, one year or 2 years left?
He's got 1 year left.
1 year left.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like he might be the favorite, he and that quarterback from Clemson. Probably be the two favorites next year for the Heisman.
Deshaun Watson and Clemson, they played a great game. What did you think of him?
Oh, I was just I felt like going in, he had to have a great game for Clemson to stay in the ball game against Alabama because of Alabama's defense. And he ripped them to pieces. He threw for 400-something yards against them. And that's something nobody else could do. And I thought he was the best player on the field. He and I started to say that tailback for Alabama, but I don't know if he wasn't the best player on the field.
Bobby Bowden is our guest, two-time national champion at Florida State. What do you make of what's become of the system? Because you were coaching when the system was changing, and where are we at now? Is it better than what college football had for a postseason, or do you see some flaws in this?
Well, you know, when they first decided to go for playoff, I was not for it. You know, between me playing ball and coaching for 57 years, I spent 60 years in football, and we never had a playoff. It was always voted, and they always got it right. It's not hard to pick out one and two, and so I really didn't care if they went to the playoff. But after they did it, I liked it.
Yeah, and I wonder. Do you think we need an expansion? Would you like to see two more teams in there, or does it start to get too big?
It starts to get too big, in my opinion. I never thought they'd go to a playoff. I didn't think the administrators they fought it for years, you know. I didn't think they would go for it, but money plays a pretty doggone big role. And but now to extend it more, I say no. But I said no before this playoff, and I like it now. But no, I don't want to see it go to eight.
Florida State and what you built there is remarkable, and I hear it brought up over and over again. you know, we want to be what Florida State was. We want to build in, you know, Oregon State is in the middle of rebuilding right now. How difficult was that for you to get Florida State on the map? And as you look back, how proud are you of what you built?
Well, I'm very happy about what happened. I don't know why I'm so lucky to come to Florida State at the right time. In the first place, there's all kind of football players in the state of Florida. I think the biggest production of college football players is California first, Texas second, and I think Florida's third. And there's just so many players here, so I happened to come at a good time, and we recruited well. And got the and there's several years we got the best players in the state. And if you can dominate your state, you're going to win in Florida. You're going to win in Texas. You're going to win in California. And we were able to do that, you know. And so we had a lot of success.
A lot of Oregon fans, a lot of people watching Oregon, see them take a step back this last year. They didn't defend very well. They had problems when their starting quarterback was hurt. You know, do you see that window closing, or as a coach, is that just an opportunity to sort of regroup and move forward again when you have an off year like that?
I think they can regroup. They have the – now, we're talking about Oregon State.
Oregon Ducks, yeah.
Yeah, they've got as fine a facilities as anybody in the country. And any prospect that visits Oregon and sees those facilities is going to have a desire to go there. He might choose another school later on, but he's going to be so impressed with their facilities. So I think it's just a matter of regrouping. You know, no, you can't – I mean, when they played that game against TCU, when they lost that quarterback, that was it. It was unbelievable. You know what? I mean, TCU couldn't stop him. But then he gets hurt. Then all of a sudden you're equalized, and then the other team, TCU, got momentum. And but had he not got hurt, I just think the other night, last night, what if Watson got hurt at the half and got knocked out of the game? No doubt, Alabama, I think, would have dominated it.
I'm watching the second half of this game, and when Alabama does the onside kick, they sort of grab the lead. But I kind of felt like if the game had played on and on and on, Was Clemson the better team? I mean, or were they more dangerous? If they play this 10 times, do they split 5-5? What does Bobby Bowden think?
They're definitely the most dangerous team. They are dangerous as long as that quarterback can stay healthy. And if they played again, they might win the doggone game. I mean, look at the mistakes. They had an interception. The only turnover of the game, they threw an interception, Bama scored. They blew coverage two times and just gave Alabama a long touchdown, you know. Then they returned that kickoff a touchdown, but that was a little bit more earned. And so Clemson, without mistake, in my opinion, that in that game, if Clemson don't make errors, if they don't make errors in that coach, and you know, something that might have hurt them worse than anything was when that good defensive back went out of the ball game. Because there are so many times when you have a guy like him that knows what he's doing, he's experienced and a veteran, when your team doesn't line up properly like they didn't do, he might have recognized that and told the safety, hey, get back. You know, he might could have corrected that. You just don't know. So you lose a valuable player like that, just like Oregon lost that quarterback against TCU. It can just turn the game around.
Coach, did you ever coach one of your players' kids?
Many times. I coached 57 years. You can imagine how many sons I coached.
Yeah. So, I mean, the faces just change and turn over, and you start over, and it's so mentally exhausting, and you see burnout everywhere. How did you stay fresh amid all that?
Let me tell you a little something. Like I told you, I coached 57 years. I graduated from college and started college coaching my very next year. And so 57 years of coaching. And then I retired. I didn't want to, but I did. I retired. And all of a sudden, I didn't have to worry about recruiting anymore. All of a sudden, I didn't have to worry about grades. I didn't have to worry about recruiting. I didn't have to worry about those 2 o'clock phone calls you get from the police department anymore, you know? And all of a sudden, the weight was just lifted off of my shoulders. And for 57 years, I didn't realize it was on there. But that's trying to answer your question about the pressure that coaches are under, and they don't even know it.
You just become – that becomes normal.
That becomes part of life. That's the nature of the game. I told my sons when they got into coaching, you know, you're not going all your games. Now, when Terrier started coaching, he won his first 20. He thought he was going to win all his. But it finally caught up with him, you know. But I told him, look, it's the nature of the game. And there's going to be ups, there's going to be downs. You're going to have friends, you're going to have enemies. And but again, if you can't handle that, just don't get out of it, you know. But they all three of them decide to stay with it.
All right. When you start your football playing career in college, you're on Alabama's freshman team in 1948. You get a chance to watch and coach against Bear Bryant, and now you see Nick Saban. Are there similarities between Bear Bryant and Nick Saban? But is it so different when they coached and how they coached that you can't compare?
I think the times are different, and you can have a perspective on it. You know, you can have your opinion on it. But, you know, I grew up a Bear Bryant fan. I coached only 50 miles away from him when I first started coaching, and I just admired him all of his career. And it's hard for me to think somebody's better than him, you know. But I guarantee you, this guy they got down there now can make his case.
I look at your coaching career, and, I mean, it's winning and winning and winning. You know, maybe your first season at Florida State when you were 5-6,
yeah.
You know, or West Virginia, you had 1-4-7 year. Other than that, you just won. How is it that you won all the time with that kind of consistency? Because you didn't always have the best players.
Well, that's true. When I was coaching at West Virginia, we played Penn State every year. Joe Paterno was there, and they won two national championships during that time. And we never beat them. I never could beat them. Why? They had better players. It's as simple as that. My philosophy of coaching was very simple. Whoever gets the best players are going to win. Now, a coach can mess that up now. You know that. You can get a poor coach, and he can mess that up. But if I can coach as good as you can coach, and I've got better players than you, I'm going to beat you. You know it? And that's where Saban does he does a great job of evaluating players and picking out guys that play the way he wants them to play. And then he does a great job of disciplining them and leading them, you know, and that's why he's there. And he's liable to be there another year. If I know him, he'll have another great recruiting year.
We're talking to Bobby Bowden, legendary coach, Hall of Fame coach, two-time national champion. Lane Kiffin's on the Alabama sideline, and right out of this game, you know, the Tennessee Titans want to talk to him, and fans are confused. They say, why is Lane Kiffin's name always come up? He hasn't been successful as a head coach. What do you see happening with Lane Kiffin?
Well, I tell you, I imagine he has matured a whole lot since the things that happened to him, getting fired up there with Oakland, and then getting fired at Southern Cal, and we left Tennessee, and everybody couldn't stand him and all that. And so he's had a couple of years to mature. Now, however, here's the thing about it, and you kind of hinted at it. When assistant coach becomes a head coach, you don't know if he's going to be a good head coach or not. There's some guys that are made to be assistant coaches, and they're brilliant assistant coaches that can't be head coaches. And so the question is still out, can he organize and lead a team now after he's had a couple of years of experience at the University of Alabama under one of the best coaches ever? And that's still a question mark. If I had to guess, I would think surely he's learned his lesson of how to handle people and how to handle the press, you know, which would give him the experience to be a successful head coach. But you never know.
Are there guys that you coached with that just weren't head coaching material, that they were better assistants?
I had an assistant coach on my staff that I thought was one of the best coaches I had. I still think he's one of the best coaches I ever had, assistant coaches. He became the head coach at South Carolina. And the first year he took them to a bowl. That's the first bowl he'd been to in years. And he didn't last but 3 years.
Bobby Bowden is our guest. Chip Kelly at Oregon was successful. He went to the NFL, and the players didn't seem to like some of the things he wanted to bring in. Why'd Bobby Bowden never dabble with an NFL job? Was it just not for you?
Yeah, it just wasn't for me. I had several opportunities. I think all I would have had to say was yes and could have taken over a couple of jobs. But I'd rather coach the college boy. I'd rather coach the guy that's 18, 19, 20 years old than a guy making $10 million more than me.
Yeah, you like that.
Yeah. I really enjoyed college and had – usually when I was have a pro team approaching me and sound like they were about to offer me a job, it didn't take me about an hour to say no.
Bobby Bowden is our guest. The kids, how did kids change in 57 years?
Well, they do change. There's no doubt about it. But you know where the big change comes? The big change comes from families. They ain't got families anymore. I know the last years I coached at Florida State, I would say that 65%, maybe 70% of my players did not have a daddy at home. Boys need a daddy. They need a father. They need a male figure. They're raised by mamas. They're raised by grandmamas. They're raised by big sisters, you know, and thank goodness for them. Oh, thank goodness for them. But I think one of the big difference is not so much the young man, but the lack of a father to discipline him and teach him right from wrong.
You became dad to a lot of kids, didn't you?
Yeah, I used to tell my coaches that we've got to be the dad to these boys because a lot of them had never had a dad. I mean, you can't imagine the kids I had that came to Florida State. Not a whole bunch of them, but had never been told no. They had a sweet mama who had about three different jobs and eight kids, you know, and had never been told no. And when he came to Florida State, and we jump on him about something and say we want it done this way, not that way, you know, he'd look at you like, well, who are you to tell me what to do? You know, you could break them. They stick with you. You could break them. But that's the way they were raised.
We saw in the NFL playoffs the Minnesota kicker missing a field goal cost his team the game. You had some kicks over the years that your kickers missed.
Boy, I could relate to that one. Oh, my goodness. Two years in a row, we played the University of Miami. And came down in the last 30 seconds, and we're inside the 40, and we missed two doggone field goals, and they won a national championship, and it's the only game we lost. You know, we'd have won it if we'd have kicked those goals. So now I can understand that, and boy, I felt so sorry for that guy.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of that, I don't think I could kick a ball with a laces facing me. You know, when I hit that ball, when I kick that ball, I want that leather in front, you know. And they had the laces right back there, and that probably didn't help him at all.
Coach, we love having you on, and we'd love to have you on again. Thanks for making time for us.
Hey, it's always good to talk to y'all. And by the way, I like your questions.
Thank you, Bobby.
You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show. Stay tuned for more.
Hey, John Canzano here. I don't know how you found your insurance agent, but I found mine in line at a coffee shop. I turned around. I started talking to Rusty Houston about homeowners insurance, life insurance, automobile insurance, and I realized this is a guy that I had to have advocating for me. Rusty Houston, Farmers Insurance. He'll look out for you. He looks out for my family. He can do the same for you. Give him a call at 503-372-9543. That's 372-9543. Or online at Rusty Houston Farmers Insurance.
You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show. Stay tuned for more.
Second baseman Wally Backman, now in Vegas with the Las Vegas 51s, joining us. Where are you today, sir?
I am in Las Vegas. We have an off day, and we travel tonight to Albuquerque.
You are in a unique position because there's all this debate and discussion about the NFL to Vegas or the NBA to Vegas and will it work and should it be there? And you are there. You must be looking around going, what's the big deal?
You know, I really believe that Vegas could support not only the NHL, but the football as well.
Is it difficult to get guys to focus, or are you playing and so busy that, hey, you could get distracted anywhere?
You can get distracted anywhere, I think. I think, you know, the key to – this is my fourth year here in Vegas, and I always feel if I can get the players through the first couple of weeks of the season, they either lost too much money and decided they got to just stick playing baseball and go from there. But, you know, it's really not bad here. The travel's good out of Vegas. But again, I really believe that, you know, we get good support for AAA baseball here in Vegas, and I believe that for sure the NHL would be very supportive here.
You are a member of the Oregon Sports Hall of Fame, and you were inducted in 2002. What do you remember of that experience? Did you even know there was an Oregon Sports Hall of Fame?
Well, you know, there's something had come up, and I couldn't. I wasn't able to come to it. My older brother Mike was the one that accepted it and gave the big long speech, and I truly wish that I would have been able to be there, but unfortunately wasn't able to be there.
Wally Backman joining us. When you start out with the Mets and you're drafted as a first rounder, what kind of dreams did you have?
Playing in the big leagues and winning a World Series.
Happened fast for you, or did it feel like it took forever?
You know, it really didn't. You know, I signed out of high school out of Alola in 77, and I ended up in the big leagues when I was 20 years old. There was a couple of times after that where I went back and forth to the minor leagues, but I thought I made a good choice. I thought I had a good career, played with some great players and played for some great managers as well.
Wally Backman with us, 86, as we play that clip and the Mets win the World Series. And, you know, what is that like as a player when all that work and all that journey and it comes to that moment where you're winning?
You know, it's so gratifying to be able to accomplish that feat. And until you're really done playing or however long you play, it's every player's dream is to go to the World Series and win a World Championship. And, you know, I go back and think of people that I played with, Rusty Staub, that played for 22 years, never won a World Championship. And to be able to win that World Championship, I think that is by far the ultimate dream for any athlete at any level, at any sport. And you just don't realize it when you're playing, that your playing days are always numbered. And, you know, if it's 10, 12, 14 different years that I played, in the big leagues and was only able to accomplish that one time, for guys not to be able to accomplish that is kind of sad, because that's what you play the game for. That's at any level, in any sport, you play to be a champion, and I was fortunate to be able to be one of those.
The life as a player and life as a coach or a manager, you don't ever get that adrenaline rush again, do you?
As a coach, you do. I mean, if you don't, you shouldn't be coaching. I think that I want to win just as bad as a manager as I did as a player. And it's a little bit different at the minor league level, because you're still developing. And once in a while, you still have to take a lump here or there because of development. But I think the ultimate goal is to win, because I think when you're a winner, you're developing. I think that's one of the biggest parts of development is winning, because when you send a player to the major leagues, he needs to be able to do the little things, be able to move the runners over, get a runner over from second or from third base with less than two out. They've got to be able to do those little things to be an accomplished player when they do get to the major league level.
Are you finding guys at the level that you're at that know that, or are you doing a lot of teaching still?
Still doing a lot of teaching. Not as much as I thought you'd have to do. This year's a little bit different. I have two number one picks in Gavin Cecchini and Brandon Nimmo that are very young players. I think they're 22 and 23 years old, and there's still a lot of development involved. You know, usually at this level, it's a lot of polishing. You polish players just to get them to the big leagues, but there's still development involved, yes.
1977, you're a first-round pick, and you probably have that. You're able to sit and talk with these guys and go, look, I've been there. As a first-round pick, you get a September call-up to the Mets. You make your debut September 2nd, Dodger Stadium, in your first at-bat. Who was the pitcher?
I believe it was Bert Hooten.
You remember the pitch?
It was a fastball. Base hit up the middle. Got a 94 hopper.
Line drive in the scorebook.
Yeah, after the game's over, it looks like a line drive. I know I struck out the second time, hit a ball off the left center field wall in my third at bat, and that's about as far as I remember.
After that, does it become a blur for you? Because, I mean, if you stop too long to celebrate, I mean, the team picks up, you're in a new city, here's a new series.
You do. You know, I mean, it's nice if you can relish the moment for a long time. But you really can't, because you're exactly right. You know, it's another day, it's another city. and you got to go out and do your job still.
The job that you do as a manager in the minor leagues, you know, there's got to be some part of you that wants to get back to the big leagues. You've made that journey before.
There's no doubt.
How important is that to you to get there?
Well, that's the reason that I do what I do today. I think I have a lot to offer. I really believe I know how to run the game, and I know how to make players better. I know how to put players in positions to succeed, and you know, that's what I'm really all about.
When you get a guy on your team that gets that call to the big leagues, you get to deliver that message?
Yes, I do. In a lot of different ways, I get to deliver that message.
How do you do it?
Well, you know, some guys are different. You know, you end up pretty close. You're like a family. They're like your kids. And, you know, certain individuals, it's like, when I sent Ty Kelly to the big leagues, kid had played 8 years in the minor leagues, and we signed him as a free agent this last year. I called him in my office and told him, and he said, "Really? You're not screwing with me, are you?" I says, "No, I get to go into the big leagues, kid. So, you know, make the most of it." So it's actually a fun time.
We're talking to Wally Backman, former World Series champion, now a manager in Las Vegas with the 51s. That 86 team and the personalities on it, I mean, do you look back at that and realize, like, how you have Dykstra and you have Strawberry and you had Keith Hernandez and Mookie Wilson and Gary Carter? I mean, it just, what an assembly of talent and personality.
It was, you know, I mean, the one thing that I remember the most, I think, of those years in New York with those players that you just mentioned was we did not want to lose. And, if we did lose a game, you play so many games, you're going to lose some. But we took it personal. And, you know, you beat me today, tomorrow we're going to beat you worse. And that's the attitude that we took out on the field. That's the attitude I try to instill in the players that I have today. You got to take this game personal.
I try to tell young people how good Daryl Strawberry was and how good Dwight Gooden was, but I don't think I can do it justice. The natural ability that those two guys had, can you give that justice?
Yeah, and they're second to none. Both of them, you know, barring the issues that they had, you know, through their playing career, I believe would have been Hall of Famers without a question. You know, I played with Barry Bonds. I played with some great players, Kirby Puckett and Daryl Strawberry, Dwight Gooden. They're second to nobody. And it's unfortunate that what happened throughout their career happened, but I'm still great friends with them. You know, they've got their life straight now, and, you know, that's a good thing, and that's what you care about.
Can we blame New York for what happened to those guys? I mean, if they had been in, you know, another city, if they'd been in Kansas City, do you think it would have ended differently for them?
There's no question it would have. I mean, New York's the major capital of the world, the biggest sport franchise in all sports. And there's so much that happens there, and there's so many different things that can happen there. You know, it's easy to get caught up in what's going on. And at that young of age, it was tough. You know, I mean, today I think baseball is better represented in those certain situations when you take a young player up. You know, they don't really coddle them. But I think they really watch every step they take, you know, like Michael Conforto that went to the big leagues for the Mets. It's, you know, from the Northwest. You know, the Mets have watched out for this kid. He's got a great head on his shoulders. He's only 23 years old, I believe. But what a career this kid might have.
When you see a player like that who comes through, or you get a chance to spend time with them in spring training, and are they open to sitting down with you and you going, "Look, I've been in your shoes. This is what happened to us. This is what I wish I would have known back then." Do you get that reception from players?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They want to know what it was like. Players are players. That doesn't change. Everybody says the game has changed. The game hasn't changed. The sabermetrics have tried to change the game. And actually to a good part of the game. But players ask a lot of questions, and, you know, there's so many different things today that you can't do the things that happened in the past with the social media and things like that. But players really want to know what it was like. And it's really no different, except you got to be careful. and you got to really assert yourself to what you're doing on the field. And you know, you're a leader to a lot. You know, the kids look up to you. You know, those players understand that. I understood it as a player, but still, we had our party times, we had our good times, but if there was social media at that time, it probably would have changed all of us as well.
Good Lord. Dwight, I was looking at Dwight Gooden. He was 19 years old. He was in the big leagues, and he won 17 games in New York. I mean, it was like he owned the city.
It doesn't happen very often when a kid's that young. You've got to realize that at that point, I think when Dwight came up, there was only 26 teams in the big leagues, and now there's 30. So he was a very special person.
He still is. I know people will talk about, you know, greenies in the minor leagues and stuff like that, but in that level and at that time, did you see drugs around the team? Did you worry at that time that, hey, this could unravel?
You know, all those eras have been different, you know, and you're right. The greenies was part of the game in the 80s, probably the 70s as well, even into the early 90s, you know, when the steroid thing became an issue. There's been so many different things that's happened in the course of baseball that baseball's tried to clean up, and I think they've done a pretty good job of it. But I think that what has happened is the Players Association, Major League Baseball, they've tried to clean the sport up and done a decent job at it, just because I think that they care about the players more today than they did before. Before, when I played, it was, hey, what can you do for me today? It's not about what's going to happen in the end. They don't care about the end back then. And now I think that the Major League Baseball cares about the individual as an individual.
That's an interesting change, because I think you came up in an era where it was guys like J.R. Richard and incredible talents that just came off the rails.
Yeah, no, and I think that it was part of that. I mean, it was part of what a player had to do to stay on the field every day. You know, players in my generation, you did whatever you had to do. I mean, if it was a cortisone shot to stay in the game for the next day, you did it. Today, if they have to take that, they got to take a few days off and go through rehab or do whatever they've got to do. And in my era, you played hurt. There was no question. I think the money has made the game a little bit different, in the sense that agents are really calling the shots, and they don't want their player out there if it's a nagging injury. And before, it was you did whatever you could to play. You know, it's to me, it's we send a player to Florida if they're hurt from the major league level or even the minor league level, and it's I understand that they're going to get their work done and get their rehab done, but it's like a country club for these guys. It's take your time, make sure you're ready. Don't come back before it's time to come back or you feel that you're 100%. But I can honestly say that I couldn't tell you. I played more games where I wasn't 100% than games that I did. So that part of the game has changed.
Wally Backman, manager with the Las Vegas 51s, former World Series champion with the 86 Mets, is our guest. I was looking back at your career numbers. You hit 10 career home runs. Yeah, you were not a home run hitter. You were a guy that, you know, for people listening, you hit first or second in the order often. I noted that 8 of those 10 home runs came with your team tied or behind. Now, tell me if I'm nuts, but my theory there is they didn't want to put you on base. They've got a lead or it's a tie game. They're not walking Wally Backman. And
No, they didn't want to walk me. They pitched to me, and they come after me. I wasn't a home run guy, and you're right. 2 of those 10 home runs were inside the park home runs, just so everybody knows that Wally Backman can run a little bit. So. But no, you know, I mean, I was a guy that created the havoc on the bases. I could steal a base. We could make a lot of things happen when it was when he was leading off and I was hitting second. There was a lot of things that could happen. I go back to times where Lenny and I had a sign amongst ourselves that if he got on base, I'd grab my helmet, he'd be stealing, I'd be bunting, and then I would bunt the ball to third if it was a strike, and before you know it, the start of a game, it's first and third, there's nobody out. So, you know, we have some of those things. They didn't want us on base. You know, that, so to speak, the solo home run doesn't hurt you. It's the 2- and 3-run home runs that hurt you.
Wally Backman with us. You mentioned Dykstra. What was he like as a competitor?
he would compete. You know, I mean, you've seen the plays where he's dove into the wall, and he did whatever it took to win. And he just took it one extra step, I think, you know, towards the end of his career. So, but when he was a great teammate, he's still a great friend. We just had our World Series reunion last week, I think it was, or 10 days ago, whatever it was, in New York. We all had a great time.
Does everybody go to those, or are they like class reunions where there's some guys who just go, you know, I want to leave the past in the past?
No, pretty much everybody went. I think the only two people that didn't go was Doug Sisk wasn't there, who lives in Washington State, and Roger McDowell, of course, is the pitching coach for the Braves. I think those are the only two, except other than Gary Carter that passed away.
Yeah, and, you know, Carter is, you know, I don't know. I know only from what I watched of those teams. But Carter seemed like such a leader, and of course, with that young pitching staff and Gooden, that get a guy like that on out there. What did he mean to that team?
He was the ultimate professional. He was. He meant everything. He meant more to the pitching staff than he meant to everybody else. But for a guy to come in the way that he came in, to run a pitching staff the way that he ran a pitching staff, was absolutely second to none.
You hit 5-10. Lifetime off Rick Mahler.
Mahler,
yeah. 5'10" in a lot of at-bats. What was it about Rick Mahler that you love to see?
Hey, any ball that I hit, it had eyes. I'd hit a line drive, it'd be a base hit. I'd hit a 54 hopper through the infield. Every ball that I hit was a hit, it seemed, against him. It was fun to face the guy. I remember one story that I'll make short, but when I went to Philadelphia, I was in Philly in 91 or 92, and Jim Fregosi was my manager, and Rick Mahler was pitching one day, and I was towards the end of my career, and we had Mickey Morandini, and I went into his office, and I said, Jimmy, I says, damn it, I says, this guy, I killed this guy. He says, yeah, I know, but Morandini's a rookie, and we think that if you were getting three hits off him all the time, he'd probably get a couple hits tonight, so we're going to leave him in there, so. You know, crazy stuff happens.
Crazy indeed. We wish you the best, Wally Backman. I really appreciate your time. We'd love to get you back on. And when you get that big league job, we'll get you back on and celebrate.
Sounds great, guys. Take care, man.
Thank you for listening to the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.